This is a view just at Dubuque, up in the top of the beautiful park up there. This is a great river, and we have to appreciate that. It's more than just a carrier of water. And those of us that live between the great rivers, we live between the Missouri and the Mississippi, can really appreciate that. The rivers are so important to our economy and to our country. Part of it, of course, is because of the fables of the past. Mark Twain made made the Mississippi so real in the past, and he's a great read anytime, just like a Leopold. But what we're doing today then is talking about what this river is carrying, why it's carrying it, some of the impacts it's going to have. And I'm going to slide into that terrible word called policy a little more, and we'll be working on policy, and when police and policy kind of come together sometimes, we don't want that to happen, but we're going to be talking that way. This is the upper Mississippi River Basin. We've seen the whole basin a couple of times now with Whitney's talk and with Jane's talk. The upper Mississippi has a particular impact, as we've seen already, in terms of the inputs that we have, in terms of the agriculture that's going on in this particular section of the country. As you can see there, the agriculture is the tan part of this particular graph. And except for upper Wisconsin, and a little bit down there in Missouri, it's an agricultural basin, and just happens to be everything is working right there for it to be a highly productive region. And so it does really encompass then Minnesota, Missouri, Wisconsin, Missouri, Iowa. Iowa's a big chunk. Let's say Illinois, and so we've got a kind of a five-state region here that's pretty big. And so when we put this together, some of the data that's out there, this is the same kind of a show that Whitney had, but it's a little different presentation. Here we can see how the corn, as Whitney's pointed out, it's pretty much been here all the time, even 1920 to the present. Not a lot of difference in acreage. Way different than we grow it, but a lot of difference in acreage. The biggie is soybean that's really come up there and caught up with corn. And to its expense then has been the hay, the meadows, oats, which is crushed to nothing, and the wheat, which is chuggling around, but you're going to probably see some increase with some of the prices. These things are somewhat market-driven, but not as much. Here is the USDA projections to 2016 for what's going to happen. Now, this was a biofuel-oriented paper that they just put out, or report. Unfortunately, they tend to use the rearview mirror for a lot of their projections. And so you can see that they just got corn up where it is now and then just took it on at about 90 million acres and took that out at the expense of soybean. But every year is going to be different. We're going to see a lot of adjustment. And it's a very volatile world out there right now in terms of what we plant and how we plant it. This kind of repeats what you saw again with Whitney's. This is the historic vegetation of Iowa, pretty much a prairie situation. The current land cover then is pretty much a corn, soybean cover, with a little bit down here where it's a little too difficult to grow corn and it's much more in the pasture area. Why just these few crops? Well, I think that's pretty obvious. Government support in many ways, from subsidies of various kinds over the years, ins and outs, insurance programs, but also the support they've given us to do the research it takes to grow corn and soybean in an incredibly efficient manner. These technologies and advances have increased our yields. They've made things much easier to grow. We can grow corn and soybean pretty much on prescription from Indiana to northern Iowa or to Minnesota. About the same prescription all the way through. Biotech has helped a lot. Equipment advances have continued to help. Those of you who have been in agriculture over the years have seen this happen. This has all allowed expansion of farm size with less labor. So we get into the sociology issues here, which we won't spend any time on, but it's an important part of what happens out there in the land. And so we really get the shift in farm size, as Whitney showed, so just from a lot of crops and a lot of land, a lot of fields, down to just a few. And we've developed many markets and uses for corn and soybean, and we will continue to do so. This market thing is what's driving where we're at right now. Policy has developed a market for ethanol. You can just make that statement. Biodiesel comes in a little bit, but not much. So it's a market-driven thing, economy that's really changing what's going on in the landscape. This is coming to the attention of Washington. I've been involved in a couple of Academy science reports. This is the first one that came out, might have been August, called Water Implications of Biofuel Production in the United States. There's a lot on this slide. Don't bother to read it all, but I will point out that this is talking about how water use and water quality are expected to change as agriculture changes to the more energy-intensive crops. This is going to be a big issue as we consider the context of U.S. policy and the expected advances in technology and agricultural practices. And this was particularly oriented to water quality and quantity, especially quantity, but they were really worried about what ethanol is going to do to the water supplies of the Midwest, especially, but other areas too where water is quite short. There was a second one that was just out last month, Mississippi River Water Quality and the Clean Water Act, much more oriented towards regulations than the earlier one was, which is oriented towards just straight policies. And this is pulled out of their report. Key issue in the Midwest agriculture today is a potential increase in cropland production dedicated to biofuels. Recent interest in biofuels are encouraging producers to extend and intensify crop production in much of the upper Mississippi River Basin. So that's where we're at. And they're worried about this being expanded production being in corn, which entails large applications of nutrient fertilizers. Another highly reviewed Academy report. Both some people in the audience have been well involved with this report, are quite familiar with what has been going on. We saw this graph in one form or another just the last talk, especially with Gene's talk, the data for what's going on in hypoxia, where they can so beautifully measure this by looking at what's going on in the May, especially the May input of nitrate to the Mississippi River outlets. And here is the latest projection. Gene might want to comment later when we get time in the discussion section as to how close they're going to hit that projection based on another rather large increase in nitrate. The data is not complete, but I think this is about where they were in June or July. And they've been incredibly good. I wish we could do that good down at Harrods. We could all go home very rich. But Gene has done a great job with this. This is older data, but it's the same sort of data we've seen in some of the least recent reports from Crompton, looking at the percent row crop as opposed to the nitrate in concentration. Smaller watersheds respond very quickly to this with very high nitrate levels up here, 14 parts per million or so. This is over many years, many, many crop years, lots of weather patterns. Smaller watersheds, larger watersheds, they kind of tend out, but here's the interior of Mississippi River Basin. More row crop, a lot more nitrate, and this is Iowa data. So they've looked at a lot of streams right in and watersheds right within Iowa. There's a tendency, it looks to me like, for spring input of nitrate to go down. Maybe I'm wrong about this. I don't know for sure how to sort this slide out. But here's the input in terms of flux and the years, water years, to 2005. Now, that's not 2006 and obviously not 2007, so there must be something still going on because we're seeing in the other graph that hypoxic zone is tending towards a rather marked increase just recently. So here's, but here does show that I think the May one is the yellow one, seemed to be more or less steady, maybe going down, but all input is going down, but that doesn't seem to reflect too much in the nitrate. In the hypoxic zone. Here's some very, very recent data we got out of the Des Moines Water Works. It's bounced around quite a bit. It took some revisions because some of their modeling wasn't quite clean, but this was revised as of about a week ago, and the Water Works people were pretty happy with it. They do water quality measurements right at the Raccoon River, which is where the intake is for the water supply for Des Moines, and you'll see it's just like you ran into a wall. Going longer, bouncing up and down with nitrate input, bang, 2007 spring output took off way, way beyond any point of record. And nobody knows what's going on, but this thing does jump. Is this biofuels? Is this too much corn? Is this overapplication of nitrogen? Or is there something else going on? And I'm wondering if it's climate change as well. Now, maybe I shouldn't call it climate change. It's different weather patterns, but it appears to be a persistency that's going on. There's a couple of papers that I've looked at recently. There's quite a few out here. It's very good work by Gene Tackley and his students at Iowa State, showing there a 21% increase in future precipitation simulated by the regional climate model. This is in the Iowa area. Will show up as more snowfall, but a 51% increase in surface runoff and 43% increase in groundwater recharge. This past winter was quite warm in the Midwest. Some of the tile lines never quit flowing all year long. And so maybe that's that spring blast that we've gotten. Maybe it'll keep repeating. Other data has been done through Iowa DNR showing the changing land cover. This is a land cover issue as well. From perennial mixed cropping systems to row crops of corn and soybeans, is increasing base flow and is likely to contribute increased nitrate and losses to the Midwest. So we're getting two things going on here, land cover change and maybe a change in the weather patterns. Drainage tile is a big villain in this whole thing, but you can't farm without it. This is just last year, and they're putting in drainage tile in a field that's had the old type tile. This is the new, of course, perforated pipes. The old tile has been in it for probably a century, give or take. And they put these in at much closer spacings in the past. You get drier fields, higher yields, but you also get much better chance for nitrate to take off and head towards the river basins. This is kind of a busy slide, and I'm not happy with it yet. I need to work on it even more. But when we're looking at what's going on out there in terms of biofuels, there's a lot of different avenues that we're going to see explored, a lot of them through the university systems we have here. I'm not sure I'm using the right word for pyrolysis, but this is essentially the conversion into several different kinds of products, from something that looks like diesel oil to more combustible fuels. And we need to do more life cycle analyses on these to see where we go in terms of the nitrate, in terms of what we're going to do and what they're going to do towards nitrate sources and sinks. I'm not sure about these columns either. This is just a very unexpert judgment of what's going on. But we do have a lot of things that are being talked about in the Midwest. The residue, which is going to make a major problem with erosion. We don't know whether it's a local problem or not. There's not much local return to ethanol. There's not much. We don't know what's going on with this kind of a system, but there's a good chance that it could be much more localized in smaller farms, or smaller firms. But as of yet, it's not subsidized. Ethanol from sweet sorghum has been talked about. It probably won't get off the mark, but we don't know. Sugar beet ethanol up north has got a good possibility. A little better energy return. This is all to one, how much energy you put in versus how much energy you get out. switchgrass ethanol is kind of the big queen on the deck right now. We're not sure where it's going, but there's a good talk that it's going to have to be subsidized pretty highly. It'll certainly help on erosion. It probably will make things local return, and it could be a good nitrate sink. Pyrolysis, maybe the same sort of things. Don't know about energy return. CoFire, which is going on, that was the Sheraton Valley research. We can talk about that later, but right now it's not looking very successful in terms of an operational procedure. Prairie ethanol, that's the Dave Tillman work, looks very good, except for a couple of operational questions. Woody species, there's a lot of stuff going on out there. If you want to go, you get a pretty nice energy return from soybean. If you want to go to the most unsustainable energy source out there in terms of biofuels, you go to soybean. So perennials must be the answer. We heard that last time. We heard this before. We'll cover it again. Here's Giles Randall's data. I could go on with about 2 hours of Giles Randall's very, very excellent data out of several spots. This is Lamberton data. It just really summarizes it all right here, though. Here's the nitrate coming out of the corn-soybean system. Here it is coming out of the perennial system. So if you want to cut down on nitrate, as Dr. Turner said in his talk, to cut it down to 5,000 square miles or meters, I forget which it was, kilometers, I mean, of hypoxic zone, and you do that by 30 to 50%, you got to go to perennials. That's just the answer, as far as I can see. So can we do that? It's the only way I can see to reduce nitrate load significantly. It does not fit, however, with our infrastructure, and that in terms of everything from markets to politics, to everything. It just doesn't fit right now. But it is more suited to local production. It's much more sustainable, as we know. These are just logical statements. But there's a lot we don't know, and we heard this in the next two talks about the conversion to ethanol. There's a lot. It may be more suited to other uses of getting energy. It's going to require considerable government intervention to succeed because of the very high cost with moving bulk materials, and it's going to have to be moved to fairly local plants, which isn't the model that's being built right now. This is a graphic I pulled out of Des Moines Registry just a couple weeks ago, and they got their data right from the Renewable Fuels Association. Here's been the monthly ethanol production just the last, from 06 to 07 to July when they took the data. Here's been the spot price of ethanol peaking about almost $4 a gallon. That was when a lot of decisions were made this year to what to do this year. And we just never seem to learn that things don't always stay where we thought they were going. So here's the crash of ethanol prices right now. We don't know where it's going. The industry is looking at this pretty hard. There are plants being mothballed, or being, not mothballed yet, but being taken back off the production line as they reevaluate where they are. They're not dummies out there, especially in Wall Street, that are putting money into a lot of these projects. So what will our biofuels future look like? We're going to try and cut back on the hypoxic zone by going to a greener landscape. We're going to have to use strong government intervention. I think right now it's going to be the rearview mirror. It's going to be more of the same. And the short run might be at least another decade. Well, that means we've got another decade of increased hypoxic zone, very likely. More productive perennial landscapes, though, might win out eventually. What if we go to $200 barrel oil? Where is that? Is it going to finally make perennials competitive in a real market, not a subsidized forced policy market that the government has right now for the system? And maybe these high input prices that it takes to grow things like corn will make perennials a lot more profitable because they do have much lower inputs. So these are things that we want to think about, perhaps, and where policy might want to go and where we might want to go in terms of some of our research and education programs. So with that, I'll leave it and invite discussion later on. I think, how am I coming on time? Pardon? Okay, I'm just finished, right? Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot.